Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the oil crash and you right after this message. 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight, a perfect and a just measure shall you have." Well, you know, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 followed that scriptural principle when they put, "No state shall make anything but silver or gold coin a tender in payment of debts," into our Constitution at Article 1, Section 10. But in 1933, Franklin D. Roosevelt took our gold away, and then in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation, and in place of just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced our current practice of the first, second, and fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system, and they gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coins. Now, in the intervening 70 years, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until now we're the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our nation, Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson? To learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons in my business school conducted twice a year here at the law school in Isabella, Missouri. To learn more, why don't you call and order my free general law CD package? Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. That number, 417-273-4967. Remember, the business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about the oil crash. I talked to you a little earlier about peak oil, and I got a letter from one of my listeners, and he sent an article. He's in the oil and gas business, so I guess he knows a little something. And I thought, well, let's put his views on here, because the thing that disturbs me the most is that we've got problems without solutions. We've got a Medicare financial crisis with no solutions. The president says we're going to spend $500 billion more, and we're going to do it on drugs. We're going to give more benefits, lower taxes, and nobody's figured out how to cover the deficit, how to cover the shortfall, how to make the payments. I mean, it's like you people going out here and buying a new car. And you've got about $400 a month, and you go out and buy a car, and the payments are six. You're going to go ahead and buy the car. Payments are $600, but you've only got $400 in your budget to pay for it. And so if we raise the issue, how are you going to make these payments? The politicians come along, and they promise you more. Don't you worry about it. You vote for me, and we'll make those payments. We'll take care of everything. Well, unfortunately, out here in the real world, little Georgie Gordon has to pay his own bills and take care of himself. 51% of Americans are receiving some kind of government aid. Some kind of a government subsidy. And everyone who receives a subsidy is unable to take care of his own family. Think about it. The guy that is living on a subsidized rent program is unable to pay the rent. He has to have somebody else help him pay the rent. And somebody who's receiving WIC or aid to families with dependent children or Social Security or something else is on the government dole. He is receiving from government. He's receiving from the taxes that are being paid in. And I know some of you guys are going to say, well, I paid my Social Security money in, and I'm entitled to it. No, you're not. No, you're not. You paid your money in, and you supported the people that were on the dole at that time. There is no money in Social Security for you. And what's being paid to you is the money that is being paid in by the workers today. Now, if you had a paid-up annuity, we'd have a different story. We'd be talking about property and property rights. We're not dealing with property here. We're dealing with the eighth plank to the Communist Manifesto. Now, don't feel bad, because there's plenty of money in Social Security to meet its obligations for a few more years, but then it runs into deficit. And all of these billions and $100 billion a year that's been paid into Social Security has been paid out. And don't blame Bush for it. Clinton was doing it, and before Clinton, it was Bush, and before him, it was Ronald Reagan. So everybody has been taking the money out of Social Security and paying the general bills. It'd be like taking money out of your 401k and making your car payment, that extra $200 a month. The reason I bring this up is because we're talking about peak oil. We're talking about this coming oil collapse, and when it happens, what it's going to mean to you. And there's 300 million of us here in this country now. And George Gordon has to solve that problem for himself. And so I liken this to the Titanic trip. If I was riding on the Titanic, 1912, and I had the same information then that I have today, I saw the movie and I read the book, I wouldn't be going to bed early. And on the night of the 14th, I would be up on deck, standing in front of lifeboat number 6, because that's the only lifeboat that gets off the Titanic, remember, with men and women in it. It's the first boat off. It's off at 12 midnight when nobody else wants to get in it. They're actually looking for people to get in the lifeboat. They launched it with 28 and there was room for 90. They had plenty of room. That's the place I want to be. And just in case I don't get on that boat for whatever reason, that lifeboat, they've only got half enough lifeboats. Now, remember that story? I'm going to lash a bunch of deck chairs together, stash them under a tarp up in the bow of the ship in the dark when nobody knows what I'm doing. Now, after the ship hits the ice, after I have failed to get into lifeboat 6, and as the people on the ship are edging toward the rear of the ship, toward the stern, as the bow is sinking under the waves, I am elbowing my way forward. Excuse me, pardon me, let me through, please. And surely people are going to say, you fool, you blind, the bow is underwater. Flee for your life to the stern. And you know that makes all the sense in the world, doesn't it? From the short range, from the viewpoint of the desperate masses of people struggling to save themselves from the impending calamity, yeah, fleeing to the stern makes all the sense in the world. But the only life raft left on the boat is up in the bow. I know, because I'm the guy that built it. I lashed it together out of wooden deck chairs. The thing that's going to save George Gordon alive. Is this the time for me to be saying to people, no, no, don't flee to the stern. Follow me. I have a life raft in the bow. 1,500 desperate people following me to the bow. What do you think my chances of getting off with my life raft are going to be? So that's the time when I need to keep my mouth shut. Now, meanwhile, back on the farm, there are all kinds of people, probably well-meaning people, who have solutions. And George Bush, you know, he's got solutions for Iraq, the economy, Medicare, Social Security, you name it, he's got a solution for it. So does John Kerry. The problem is that none of these solutions make any economic sense. They're just empty slogans without, it's just rhetoric and slogans without any bottom line proof. And in this article, they got the same rhetoric coming out here concerning oil. For instance, to find more oil, we have to invest more to find it idea. Yet to be located oil globally, 210 billion barrels are left to discover and 1,000 billion barrels are left to extract. And you can get this from murdoch.edu, oil flay. There's a webpage here. Senior industry geologists' views on Campbell and LaHare's arguments are summarized in the Petroleum Review, 1998. There was general acceptance of the substance of their arguments that the bulk of the remaining discovery will be ever smaller fields within established provinces. Although most geologists thought 400 billion barrels might remain to be discovered, Campbell points out that it would take at least 35 years to find their 210 billion barrels at present discovery rates. And he says present conventional oil, that is the easy, not heavy oil or deep water oil, the easy oil, will drive production over the peak. When oil scarcity, or then oil scarcity, will make the remaining, or make mining of those remaining supplies and other options prohibitively energy costly, and the actual global oil peak date will therefore not be delayed by them. So after a century of exploration, the Earth's geology and oil resources are generally very well known. This is indicated by the 40-year decline in discovery of oil. No amount of money will create oil that the planet does not contain. Forecasts that ignore the influence of oil scarcity on extraction. For many years, geologists and oil companies have published estimates of the total amount of crude oil that will ultimately be recovered from the earth over time. Remarkably, these assessments of estimated ultimately recoverable oil have varied very little over the past half century. Now, Figure 9 in List 41 estimates dating from the early 1950s. For the past 25 years, with only two exceptions, estimates have ranged from around 1,800 billion barrels to around 2,400 billion barrels. David Woodward, the general manager of the Abu Dhabi Company for Onshore Oil Operations, also analyzed 40 estimates of ultimately recoverable oil, all published between 1975 and 93. And according to Woodward, there is a fair degree of consistency among the estimates, with the average value being about 2,000 billion barrels, and most, that's about 70%, falling in the range of 2,000 to 2,400 billion barrels. That comes from the World Resources Institute. All right, so the numbers that I've seen in the past, published in the National Geographic, said that there was 1,000 billion barrels of proven reserves. Well, at the rate that we're finding oil, at the rate that we're consuming oil, and if we were to give it double that amount, you're still going to run out of oil about 2009. That is, you're going to hit the peak. You don't run out. but you hit the peak. And that's what happened in 1973 down in Texas, from 70 to 73. You see, in America, the state of Texas was like Saudi Arabia. That is, when there was a shortage of oil, they just cranked up production down in Louisiana and Texas, Texas primarily, and solved the shortfall. And then when there was too much oil, they'd shut off the oil flow down in Texas, and that could maintain stable prices at $2.73 a barrel. Now, at peak oil in the United States, we were producing 9 million barrels. Was it 9 million a year? I think it was. We were consuming around 9 million barrels a day, I believe. Either a day or a year, I forgot now. It was 9 million. I seem to remember that number. Now, that's in 1973. And that was maximum. That's what we were consuming. We were consuming everything that we produced. There was no problem because we could import oil and make up the shortfall, and that came from other countries. Well, then came the Arab oil embargo, and they doubled and quadrupled the price. We've been through that a couple of times. Today, we're up to $50 a barrel, which adjusted for inflation is fair for the Arabs. In other words, the Arabs today are getting the same amount of money in purchasing power that they were getting in 1907, 1920, or 1930, $2.73 a barrel for their oil. Now, we've been looking for oil all over the world in the intervening years, and we're only finding oil, according to this article, at one-fourth the rate of consumption. Now, you know, I'm an old-timey businessman, and I used to have 30 employees, and we would be producing at maximum capacity. That means that we're shipping as fast as we can produce. All right, now, one day we wake up and we find that we're not shipping as fast as we're producing, so therefore we're building inventory at 10%. Well, then what that means is that at the end of the month, we're going to have a month's supply. And then at the end of 2 months, we'll have a 2 month supply, and then 3 month supply in the warehouse. Well, now, you don't have to be very bright to figure out that you've either got to cut back on production or you've got to increase sales or go broke or run out of warehouse space. In other words, it's a problem that needs to be solved. And when it comes to Medicare or Medicaid or Social Security or the economy or inflation or anything else, there are hard, fast decisions that have to be made. Businessmen have to make hard, fast decisions. We're going to have to reduce capacity by laying off some men. We'll have to cut off the swing shift or something on that order. So when we Americans start talking about Social Security, we call it the third rail of politics. No politician dares to suggest that we solve the Social Security problem with one of the only three solutions that's available: cut benefits, or delay the retirement age, or raise taxes. And the politicians, that is Kerry and Bush, have said we're not going to raise taxes, we're not going to cut benefits, and we're not going to raise the retirement age. And yet the thing is consuming money faster than it's going in. Now, that's the problem with democracy. When the people learn that they can raid the treasury, they will, and they will bankrupt the nation. And that's where we're headed, toward bankruptcy. And when that happens, there's going to be some unpleasant consequences. Just like the Titanic hitting the iceberg, there are going to be some unpleasant consequences. Now, it would make more sense to prepare for the 5,000 square miles of ice by steering south, slowing down. It would make more sense to deal with Social Security pragmatically. Every American needs to understand that Social Security cannot continue on the way it's structured today. Just like a businessman would readily understand that we cannot continue production at 10% over sales for very long. We can do it for a while, but not for forever. Social Security cannot be maintained forever. And oil production and consumption at the numbers that we're consuming and producing cannot be continued forever. So we have to have some decisions. And the decision that George Gordon made was this: I'm going to be paying $50 a gallon for gasoline. I don't want any diesel generators here generating electric power. I need solar power, and I need wood heat. And I implemented all of them, or I'm in the process of doing them. And you, as a family, I don't care where you live, in downtown Cleveland, or if you're living on a big ranch in Montana or Nevada, have the same problem, your standard of living. To maintain that standard of living, you've got to plan for $50 a gallon gas, electricity that's beyond your reach, and unemployment. You've got to heat your house. Now let's take a look at this gloom and doom. Gloom and doom is an opportunity for the other side. During the Great Depression, 25% of the people were unemployed. That's the bad news. The good news is 75% of the people were employed. And that's the 75% that we want to be selling to. In Argentina, they had choices to make in the 1990s. Their choices were, we'll continue doing just what we're doing now, which ultimately brought insolvency and default. Now they've got 60% unemployment and they're on COD. They're having a tough time of it. But in Argentina, the Argentine people are still living there. All of them. They're still there. And Argentina is still functioning, and people are getting up every day and going to work. They may be earning less money, or they may be earning more money. There are millionaires in Argentina, and there are people in Argentina making lots of money. And there are people in Argentina losing lots of money. I mean, that's just the way life is. Life goes on. And you have to be able to make your living, whether it's in boom times or bust. You still have to heat your house, whether it's 1933 or 1953 or 2003. You still have to heat the house. You still have to earn a living. The concepts that people have about depressions are based upon false premises. Some guy called up the other day and says, well, I can't go to your school. I've got to save all of my money and prepare for the coming collapse. You're going to what? You're going to save your money. How much money have you got to save? A guy that's working for wages, a guy's going to save his money and he can't afford to come to school to learn how to solve the problem? I mean, I thought that was bizarre. Think about it for a minute. Let's suppose you got $10,000. 10,000 paper dollars. These are 10,000 5-cent dollars compared to 1930. The median average income, boys and girls in America, is $41,000. You need to be making $41,000 a year to be average. So you got to have $41,000. If you got $41,000, if you get $10,000, you got enough to go to school. If you went to school, you'd learn how to make a living in boom times or bust. Now listen to this. Little Georgie Gordon here is facing the same problem you're facing. Peak oil and a busted economy. Well, wait a minute. When the economy busts, don't I still have to feed, clothe, and house myself just like I have in the past? Don't I still have to feed my family? Do you know how to do that in depressed times? Do you know how to do that when you're unemployed? Unemployed. Do you know I've been unemployed for 30 years? Yeah, that's right. I've been unemployed for 30 years. I've made more money while I'm unemployed than I've ever made in my life. There's no money in employment. And if you're employed, saving a few bucks today isn't going to solve your problem for the future. You've got to be able to make it in bad times. So you got to be able to make it when gasoline is $50 a gallon. Over in Bosnia during the Bosnian War back in the 90s, coffee was $4 a cup and gasoline was $20 a gallon. Gasoline, $20 a gallon. Not the time to be filling up your motorhome, but maybe it's the time to be filling up your rototiller and your chainsaws. Maybe that's the time to be cutting firewood. And if you can't make it in Los Angeles in times when it's bust, maybe you better be thinking in advance of getting the hell out of Los Angeles to where you can make it. Have you thought of that? I couldn't make it in Chicago or New York either, so I got out. And I'm now living in a place where I can make it, where I can heat my house, grow my food, feed my family, and pay $50 a gallon for gas, and I can still maintain my standard of living. And it's going to be that way today during good times, and it's going to be that way tomorrow during bad times. So the concepts that the government's going to solve our problem or that the oil companies are going to solve our problem is a fiction. If your problem is going to be solved, you're going to solve it. And if you can't solve it, it isn't going to get solved. Social Security benefits are going to be paid. You're going to receive your check. You're going to receive your cost of living, your COLA index increases every month. But the purchasing power of those dollars is going to go steadily down. Today you're getting $1,000 a month, and that'll buy 1,000 loaves of hillbilly bread. One of these days you're going to get $2,000 a month, and it will buy 900 loaves of hillbilly bread. And then you're going to get $4,000 a month, and it'll buy 800 loaves of hillbilly bread, and so on down the line. Oh, you're going to get the total number of dollars. Don't worry about the total number of dollars. You should be very concerned about what those dollars are going to purchase. What are you going to get for them? And the Chinese are very concerned about how much oil they're going to get for their dollars, and they're cashing their dollars in just as fast as they can to buy oil. They're going to need the oil. Now, the Arabs are taking the oil, or somebody's taking the oil, and they're buying the oil tankers and the oil. That's called panic buying. And I think that you should be a little more intelligent about the way you prepare for this ultimate catastrophe. Yeah, there's a catastrophe coming, and there's going to be a major realignment. And that means there's great opportunity out there for the guy that knows about when it's coming and how to prepare for it. And that's all I'm telling you is that get prepared for it, and let's see if we can't make a buck on it. Now, the number of oil wells in the United States and elsewhere, by the end of the 19th century, there were about 600,000 oil wells in more than 100 countries. And that came from the McGuire Energy Institute. And currently, the United States has approximately 600,000 oil wells in operation. Now, isn't that just special? Nearly 500,000 of those wells produce less than 3 barrels a day. Got that? So we got 600,000 oil wells in the United States, and 500,000 of them produce less than 3 barrels a day. Now, that's not too shabby. A barrel of oil sells for 50, and you get 3 barrels a day. That's $150 a day coming out of that oil well. And every barrel counts. We used to call those stripper wells here in the United States. Stripper wells are little guys that go out and buy these oil wells up from these big companies, and they'd go out there and work on them. Maybe they'd run this pump one day a week and pump out 20 barrels, and then they'd let it set for a week and build up some more, and then they'd pump that out. Well, now you got the environmental impact statements, and you've got the environmental people around there. They wanted to close all those down, and they're closing those wells down. Seems like to me you need more and more of them, not less and less. And again, when you decentralize and you get hundreds or thousands of people involved in an endeavor, you get greater overall production than you do when you just have a few producers. But you know, America has bought into this communist philosophy that what we want are jobs, jobs, jobs. Now, I don't think I want a job. I think what I want is property, property, property. Because with property, I can make products and products. I can use myself or I can sell them or trade them to somebody else. Let me give you an illustration. I've got about, I won't tell you how many, but I got a few cows and I got a few sheep. I have more milk than I can use or that I could drink. I could double, triple, or quadruple the production of milk that I produce every day right now. If I wanted to, I could increase it. I don't do it because it's not economically viable. But gee, with $4 a gallon milk, it might become more and more viable. Now, dairies today have 14,000 cows. So these big operations with their 14,000 cows are giving you $4 a gallon milk, milk that isn't fit to drink, that's pasteurized and homogenized, and gives you cardiovascular disease and a whole host and plethora of other diseases. And they're producing 30% less milk today than they were in 1970. So they're bigger and more efficient, producing more and more milk on less and less land with fewer and fewer people. I think what we need is more and more milk produced for less and less. Don't you? More and more produced for less so that we can increase consumption, not decrease it. Don't you? That's why I say thousands of people owning a few oil wells is better than one or two owning thousands. Stand by. I'll be right back. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, back in 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, no state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt. And that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. Now, private business is carried on in gold and silver coin, but public business is conducted in commercial paper like stocks, bonds, Federal Reserve notes. Well, back in 1965, Congress said that there's no difference in the value of gold and silver coin in clad coin or currency. Well, that's true when you're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in purchasing power of gold over paper, and a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes due on that paper over gold. Now, you know, God and our founding fathers didn't give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew, and they knew as a matter of law, that gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. They knew, and they knew full well back in 1933, that in order to subjugate the people of America, they would first have to take away their gold and silver coin in order to take away Americans' right to property and destroy their property rights. And they did just that under the first plank to the Communist Manifesto. Now, if you and I intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights. And that's because property is the legal foundation of all of our liberties. Now, let me teach you how to do just that. And this business school is now on compact disc for adult homeschoolers. For more information about my private business school, just call and order my free general law CD package. Now, that's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can call and order yours right now. That number is 417-273-4967. And my business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. So if you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email, send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about this thing of the oil crash and you. How is it going to impact upon you? It's going to impact upon me. I don't deny that. Just like the sinking of the Titanic. Hey, that's going to impact upon me as a passenger on the ship. Now, the difference is that there's going to be victims and there's going to be survivors. Now, in the business world, there are people that make money in bust times and people that lose money in bust times. Typically, in boom times, more people make money than lose it, and in bust times, more people lose it than make it. But there's people making money in boom times or bust. And the objective here is for you to be making money in either scenario. Now, I'm going to show you that there is a logical, systematic methodology. We call it reason, logic, and common sense in the business world. And life is based upon, law is based upon, business is based upon reason, logic, and common sense. And that's why I've said that I've got such a disrespect for the greenies and the environmentalists, because when you come around talking about dismantling all the dams on the Columbia River, and then you don't have an alternative source of electric power to take its place, that's just insanity. That's so dumb, we shouldn't even be discussing it, but it's being discussed in the halls of Congress, for crying out loud, which ought to send you another signal. Anybody that would discuss that kind of insanity and lunacy has his head up his rectal region, way past his ears. Way past his ears. Now, I don't want to follow along after that kind of insanity, so one of these days, somebody's actually going to do that. Do you understand what I'm telling you? These people have tremendous political power. Before this thing reaches its climax, I'll just bet you they're going to take all those dams off the Columbia River. It's got to be fish or electricity. You can't be both. Now, I used to be in the business world, and when I was faced with those kinds of decisions, I'd say, why can't we have full employment and inventory? How can we do both? Not to choose between inventory or jobs, but can we have employment? Yes, but that means that we've got to go out and sell more product. If we're going to keep our market share, if we're going to keep our employees working 12 months a year, then I've got to go out and sell more. And that's what I did. I went out and sold more. I never did have a problem keeping my employees busy. I didn't choose between employment and inventory. That's what big business does. They come along and they merge, and then they wipe out 50,000 jobs. Now, why can't we have employment and prosperity? We could. When we were on the gold standard, when we followed biblical law, we used to have both. Today, we have to choose one or the other. And now we're about to choose. We're about to make another big choice here. And I don't think that the government can solve George Gordon's problem, so I divorced myself from government and I solved my own. And I'm running a school and I'm teaching individuals how to solve your problem. You can solve this oil crash. You can solve this economic debacle. You can do it for you. I can't do it for you, but you can do it for yourself. Now listen to what they're talking about. They're saying that to find more oil, we just need to invest more money. Well, listen, the problem solves itself when you read the numbers. The number of oil wells already in the world, more than 500,000. In the United States, 80% of the wells now produce less than 3 barrels a day. The percentage of oil recovered from a typical oil well, 20 to 60%. And it relates primarily to the density of the oil. You get less oil from a heavy oil than a light one because it sticks in the reservoir. So you can only get 20 to 60% of the oil that you find. Technology will solve it. That's the idea. Challenge to technology. To compensate for the expected 3% oil decline at today's 22 billion barrels a year, create and install by the year 2009 permanent supplies of portable energy equivalent to 660 million barrels of oil a year. Then as oil keeps declining forever, increase this new energy until it replaces 40% of the world's energy supply, 22 billion barrels a year, or reduce energy demand equivalent to the global population increases by almost 250,000 people a day. Put another way, we're going to have to find an alternative energy source in the next 5 years to replace 40% of the world's energy. That isn't going to happen, boys and girls. It isn't even physically possible. Now somebody says, well, that's a problem that is so big, I'm going to ignore it. Okay, I don't care. The average listener listening to this problem being discussed here on the air can't grasp it anyway. I just say the average guy listening to me right now can't grasp the severity of this problem. And after all, I told you earlier that they were telling me that this problem was going to come in my lifetime in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, 1980s. Yeah, I've been listening to this all my life. Now, I know it's coming. We just don't know when. I mean, anybody can see that this is coming, but, you know, is it going to come in our lifetime or the next? Well, look, if it's coming in my daughter's lifetime, then don't you think I ought to do something to help ease the pain for her? Americans today are burning the candle at both ends. We're spending money like it's going out of style. We're creating debts that we're saying that we're going to have our children paying for the next 100 or 200 years. George Gordon isn't. My children aren't going to pay my debts. I'm going to pay my own way. I'm going to support myself. And I can support myself without Social Security, and I'm going to do just that. And I can solve the peak oil problem, and I've done that, and I'm going to teach others how to do that. Now, all of you people out there are not going to solve the problem, but some of you are. And, you know, some of you better than none. Now, the better efficiency idea to increase inefficiency usually fail to reduce consumption. For example, if you get more miles per gallon, now this is what the environmentalists tell us. What we need are cars that get 50 miles to the gallon. Well, we boosted consumption. A 57 Chevy used to get 8 miles to the gallon. I know, I had one. 8 miles to the gallon, 57 Chevy. Now they get 20 miles to the gallon. Okay, so when I was a kid and we had 8 miles to the gallon, we didn't have a consumption rate of 3 gallons per person per day. We had less efficient cars, but we didn't have as many cars, and we weren't driving as far. You know, today people will drive. I got a neighbor over here. He drives 87 miles one way to his job in Springfield. That's an hour and a half to work and an hour and a half back. He didn't think anything of that. He's been doing that for years. You know, when I was a kid and you had a job in Springfield, you'd move to Springfield, for crying out loud. No, not with gasoline as cheap as it is today. So more miles per gallon causes people to travel more and buy two cars, unless the users are personally determined to reduce their consumption. Well, George Gordon came along one day and said, well, I think I better reduce my consumption, get used to it. Al Gore's right. He wrote a book and he said, hey, we're running out of oil. Okay. Well, he ain't president of the United States, is he? Now, when you touch the third rail, that is, when you touch reason, logic, and common sense in the political arena, you're going to get voted out of office or you're not going to get voted in. You can't talk about, you know, you can't talk intelligently about Social Security or Medicare. Both of those problems are solvable. So if I said, well, okay, here's what the solution is, you people would say, well, we're not going to vote for that guy because he's telling us what we don't want to hear. Now let's talk about nuclear energy. I talked to you about this nuclear energy the other day. Japan produces 40% of their electric energy from nuclear power, and the French 60%. I think we ought to produce 100% of it. It's technologically feasible. Here in America, we produce 20% of our power comes from nuclear energy. And the environmentalists tell us we're going to shut all the nuclear power plants down. Then we're going to take out all the dams on the Columbia River. Huh? And you're going to replace it with what? And they talk plaintively about solar power and alternative energy forms. If you took all of the alternative energy forms in the United States, it consumes less than 1%. It produces, not consume, it produces less than 1% of our energy. I saw those numbers the other day and I reported them to you. Now 40% of our energy comes from oil, and that's going to start declining at some point here in the future. So I'm sitting here saying, okay, well, let's get ready for the decline. You know, if the economy is going to collapse, I say, okay, let's get ready for the collapse. If the Titanic's going to sink, okay, let's get ready for the sinking. I'm not going to prevent the sinking of the Titanic. I'm not going to prevent the economic collapse of the nation. I'm not going to prevent the peak oil. It's going to happen, but I can get ready for it, and then I can profit from it, and I can profit from it at your expense. And I'm sorry to tell you that, but that's just where reality is at. So, you know, if I'm ready for it, I'm going to tell you a little story here because it's pretty apropos. It had to do with a flood in 1955 in Eel River Valley in California. I'm a 15-year-old kid in 1955, and old Frank Roach had been around for 55 years at that time. I thought a guy 55 years old was an old man. Now, old Frank had about 140 cows, 240 acres there on Lighthouse Road. It was the old Herrick place for you locals up there. He had a barn 210 feet long, and it looked like a tunnel when you looked at 70 cows to a side, you know. And you got to milk all those cows. That's quite a little job. Well, anyway, old Frank had been through a flood in 1937. And he'd been through the flood back in, well, he hadn't been through it, but he'd heard about the flood back in 1907. So 30 years later came a flood, took 30 years. And then in 1955, there was another flood. Well, Frank was prepared for a flood. He knew that they occurred in the valley. You never know when they're going to happen, but, you know, they happen. And when they do, you're going to be short of feed. So old Frank had 600 tons of hay in the barn. Now, that was about a three-year supply of hay. He used about 200 tons a year. Sure enough, there was a flood occurred in 55, and so the neighbors are wiped out. Now, the neighbors are pretty modern people, you know. They're looking for money. And so our next-door neighbor, built a grade A barn and put all of his cows out on pasture and bought all of his hay from Tracy, California, trucked it in. Well, when the flood occurred, it knocked the bridges down, and he couldn't get any hay. So this neighbor came over to Frank in a panic, and he said, Frank, sell me hay. And I thought, I'm 15 years old, I'm listening to this conversation, and Frank said, I don't have any hay to sell. And they were standing in the barn. He looks in the barn. This hay is up to the rafters. I mean, it's up to the peak. 650 tons. We had 50 tons over in two other outbuildings. Frank said, I ain't got a bale to sell. And the guy, he said, Frank, you've got all this hay in here, and I need to buy this hay, and we can replace this hay. You know, we can buy it later. Frank said, well, yeah, we can buy it later, but it's going to be twice or three times as much, because now that the fields are all silted in, we're not going to have any hay this year. We're going to have to farm for the next 2 years. We're going to be down there seeding and farming and just doing everything we can to get every blade of grass we can. I'm going to be feeding hay early. Furthermore, what if we have another flood next year? He said, well, we'll not have a flood next year. How do you know? Nobody knows when a flood's going to occur. You don't know if you're going to have two floods in 1 year. You had four hurricanes down in Florida in a month, for crying out loud. You don't know when you're going to have a hurricane. You don't know when you're going to have a tornado or a second hurricane or a second flood. Look at that 1993 Mississippi flood. Flood of 100 years, they said. You don't know, but what, you'll have another one next year. You got to be prepared for it. Well, Frank was prepared. And Frank told him, he said, you know, I've got enough hay here. I can take care of my 140 cows. You made the decision to go grade A. You made the decision to make yourself dependent upon buying hay from outside sources. I produce my own. I can take care of myself, but I can't take care of myself and you too. I can feed my cows, but I can't feed my cows and your cows. God, that guy was mad. He left in a huff. And I couldn't understand it. I was 15 years old. I'd been taught as a trained American communist. I'd been to the public schools. I couldn't understand why Frank wouldn't share and share alike. I couldn't understand. My mother always told me, you share your toys. She was a communist too. I never taught my children to share their toys. I taught my children property rights. I taught my child that my child's bike was his bike, not the neighbor's, and he didn't have to share it with anybody. Neighbor kid or anybody else. Neighbor kid can go out and buy his own bike. But then, you know, that's just me, I guess. Well, I learned that from old Frank. Now, keep in mind, I'm 15 years old, trained communist, and I asked Frank Roach, I said, Frank, I don't understand this. Why don't you help the neighbor because he needs help? And Frank said, I know he needs help, and he should have helped himself. He should have 600 tons of hay in his barn just like I do. And the reason that he doesn't is because instead of having 140 cows, he's got 280. He wants to get bigger and bigger. He got greedy. He bet the farm and he lost. Now his fields are flooded and he has no pasture and he has no hay. His hay has to come in every day on the truck. He's dependent. He's not independent. He is dependent. And he said, I'm independent. I'm not depending upon the hay truck. I'm not depending upon Nielsen Feed or Yancey or anybody else. I've got my own. I can take care of my own. And he said, furthermore, we might have another flood next year or the year after. And it's going to take 3 years to recover from this, and I have 3 years worth of hay. I got hay for this winter, next winter, and the winter after that. Then I'm going to need welfare. I don't have a bale of hay to sell. I said, oh. Now it got worse. Because you see, every winter, every dairyman sells his coal cows. He gets to the end of the season, he says, well, that cow didn't produce very good this year. I think I'll sell her for beef, and I'll replace her. And typically, 140 cows, you got 40 heifer replacements. So as time progresses along, well, Frank is out here selling cows, selling his coals. Well, guess what the neighbor over here is doing? Now that he doesn't have any hay, he's selling his cows, isn't he? So he's not selling just his coals, he's selling his good milk cows. Now, Frank Roach is over at the sale barn. And he's selling his coals, and he sees these good milk cows coming through, so he sells his coals and buys guess whose cows. Boy, if you don't think that made the neighbor mad. Now the neighbor is so mad. Frank won't sell him hay so that he can keep his cows. Now he has to sell his cows, and guess who's at the sale barn buying his cows? Is it Frank Roach's fault? Is it Frank's cause and effect that created the flood? Was it Frank that made the business decision that this guy said, I'm going grade A? Did Frank make this guy dependent upon foreign hay? Frank didn't make any of those decisions for the neighbor. Frank made his own decisions for himself. Now here's Frank Rocha sitting on top of the world. He's got a 3-year supply of hay that he's probably going to need, and indeed he did need the whole 3 years. But as he sold his coals, he replaced his coals with the neighbor's good cows. Not just the neighbor's, because there were a lot of other guys in the same boat. Walter Buck Newton was in the same boat. Every grade A guy around there was in the same boat. The bridges are knocked down, the trucks can't get in. We've got these cows, now what are we going to do with them? Can't feed them. And after the flood went down, the fields are silted in, and you can't get any grass off of that. You got to go down, farm them, and reseed them. So while their grass is taking hold, you got to be feeding hay. All right, so here we are talking about peak oil. I'm sitting here saying, okay, what happens if there's no flood? Well, okay, we got 600 tons of hay in the barn. Next year, we don't need to make as much hay. We've got more pasture. We've got more crop residue that goes into the ground, decays, and makes organic humus in the soil. We rebuild our soil. Nothing goes to waste. Y2K came along, and I bought some extra supplies, and Y2K didn't consume them. I've still got my supplies. Other people took their supplies and sold them and threw them away, gave them away. Wait a minute. If Y2K doesn't materialize on an economic collapse from other causes, cause the same problem, won't you need to have a year or 2 year or 3 year supply of food, clothing, and shelter? You know, when I was a kid, I came from a different era than most of you people listening to me. When I was a child, we had a 1 year supply of food in our pantry. We had enough food to feed our family for a year. We weren't the only ones. So did the Johnsons, the Mitchells, the Aldridges, all the neighbors, everybody had a year's supply of food. It's the way people live. Today, you got 3 days supply in your refrigerator, and you're relying upon Safeway and Kroger to keep you in food. George Gordon's not. I've got a supply, and I'm not dependent upon anybody else. I'm sure that you people are going to knock on my door and say, hey, George, feed me. And I'm going to say, just like old Frank Rocha, is it my fault that you don't have a 1 year supply of food? Is it my fault that you don't have a 2, 3, or 4 year supply? You know, the Mormons were the only people in the country 20, 30, 40 years ago that had a year, 2 year supply of food. Today, they got 3 days supply, and they think that's what we need for FEMA. Okay, you Mormons out there, but you were the only people that had your heads on straight 30 or 40 years ago. Well, what made you wake up to reality and say, gosh, we might have food shortages, and we need to have a supply? And the Amish people are able to take care of themselves, and they don't have any gasoline problems, do they? Now, if you're dependent upon gasoline and it gets shut off, you've got a problem. If you're dependent upon hay and it gets shut off, you've got a problem. If you're dependent upon somebody else to feed you and it gets shut off, you've got a problem. And that's what independence is all about. You know, if I was heating with propane and it got shut off, I'd have a problem. But I don't heat with propane. And I'm sitting on 200 acres of woods. I have a 1,000-year supply of wood. Just like the United States of America has about a 500-year supply of oil locked up in the oil shale. We should be over there developing our oil shale and telling the Arabs to take that oil and stuff it. Now, we're not. We haven't, and we're not going to. But when this happens, are you going to say, George Gordon, this is your fault because you're prepared for this and we're not? You know, it reminds me of the 10 virgins that are mentioned in the book of Matthew. You got these 10 virgins and 5 of them have oil and 5 of them don't. And 5 of them are prepared for the second coming and 5 of them aren't. And then when the second coming occurs, the 5 that don't have their oil rush over to the 5 that do and they say, sell us some of your oil. Just like the neighbor said, sell me some of your hay. And Frank said, yes, I have plenty of hay, but I don't have any to sell. That's what I'm going to tell you. Yeah, I've got plenty of oil, but I don't have any to sell to you. I've prepared for myself, but I haven't prepared for you. And that's what subsistence and survival is all about. Now, the mentality of Americans 50 or 100 years ago is something different than the socialist mentality and philosophy that we've adopted under the 10 Planks to the Communist Manifesto. I don't think the 10 Planks to the Communist Manifesto have served us Americans very well. And as soon as I figured that out about 20 years ago, I divorced myself from socialism and the Communist Manifesto, and I'm suggesting that you do the same. Now, the next time when we take this up, we'll take a look at nuclear power. What about nuclear power? Next time, here on The Law Hour. All right, let me give you a reminder here, and that is that the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertiser, sponsors, management, or staff of the network or of this radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, just go to my website. That's georgegordon.org or call the school direct at 417-273-4967. All right, you've been listening to the Law Hour and editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week in the United States and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Gordon Law School and the Law Hour, please go to the website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by prearrangement only. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. Well, we're just about out of time. We've got to leave it right there. We'll take this up, the oil crash and you, next time right here on The Law Hour. So I'll see you back here tomorrow, God willing. Same time, same station. So until then, good night, friends.